Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Extremism in the name of Islam, how is it harming Muslims themselves? Welcome to today's podcast, where we delve into a pressing issue, extremism in the name of Islam. Islamic extremism, often referred to as radical Islamism, represents somehow a distorted interpretation of Islamic teachings where extremists adopt a narrow and violent approach to the religion. This radical ideology is characterized by the belief that Islam mandates the use of violence to achieve political, social, or religious goals. Extremists use selective and often misinterpreted religious texts or justify their actions, repression, and intolerance in the society. Their actions starkly contrast with the core principles of Islam, which fundamentally advocate for peace, justice, tolerance, diversity, and respect for human dignity. One of the most concerning aspects of Islamic extremism is its impact on Muslim communities worldwide. They have caused significant internal disputes within Muslim communities. These internal conflicts often manifest in increased sectarian violence, social fragmentation, and a rise in radical ideologies that challenge the values of moderation and tolerance. The actions of a radical minority have led to widespread stereotype and misconceptions about the Muslim community. Addressing this issue of Islamic extremism requires a multifaceted approach that includes counter-radicalization efforts, education, and community engagement. I, Ahrar Ramispour, explore this topic today with my fellow guest, Mr. Mustafa Akul. Mustafa Akul is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, specializing in public policy, Islam, and modernity. He has authored several influential books, including The Islamic Moses and Reopening Muslim Minds, and has been recognized as a prominent Muslim modernist and reformer by the Thinking Muslim and Prospect magazine. Alongside his role at Cato, Akul is senior lecturer at Boston College's Islamic Civilization and Societies program and directs the Islam in the Muslim World course at the Foreign Service Institute. Akul's extensive journalism career, including contributions to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and numerous other global publications. He has also appeared on major media outlets such as CNN and BBC, and his TED Talk on Faith versus Tradition in Islam has over 1.3 million views. His notable works, including Islam Without Extremes and The Islamic Jesus, have been translated into several languages. Welcome, Mr. Akul, to WIN's podcast. I would like to start with the first question, that what is extremism and how is it defined in the context of Islam? Thank you, Mr. Mustafa Akul, for you joining us today. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the kind introduction. This is a deep topic, and of course, the term extremism have become a household term. People mean different things by that. But what I mean by extremism, which is indeed a great problem in parts of the Muslim world today, what I mean is hatred, coercion, and violence in the name of Islam. And typically, the extremist groups would be groups like the Taliban, let alone ISIS or Al-Qaeda, or let's say the Islamic Republic of Iran. I would call them extremists in the sense that they are using violent power to oppress certain group of people. In Afghanistan, you know, Taliban has come to power for the second time, and they believe, for example, that a Muslim woman should not be able to go around without mahram or not even get an education publicly. Now, they might believe that maybe, but they are imposing this belief on all society, on all Afghan people. They could preach that, but instead they are imposing it violently. Same thing with Iran. I mean, the Iranian regime believes an ideal Muslim woman should wear a hijab. That's a very respectable opinion. Many Muslim women do wear the hijab. I respect it myself. Members of my family wear the hijab. but to go after women with a religious police force to force them wear the hijab, punish them if they don't, that is what I would call extremism. And of course, there are these violent terror groups who attack other Muslims, let alone non-Muslims, for reasons of their own understanding, either because for political reasons or religious reasons. So they commit things that are ethically ugly and abhorrent to a big portion of humanity, because I think humans see something evil and they understand it's something is evil. If you bomb a mosque and kill innocent women and children and men there, calling them infidels or murtads or apostates, you are doing something clearly evil. But those people who are doing this are claiming that they are doing this in the name of God. So we do have this problem across the Muslim world in different shades and grades. It begins with hatred. It begins with hatred in the sense that when you say this group is a group of murtads, apostates, they're corruptors, they are infidels, and for those, we should hate them, we should renounce them, and that hatred builds up. And when you have power, you put that hatred into coercion and violence. That's why I think we should clearly go after violent acts and condemn them, but we should also discuss why this hatred begins. And one thing I emphasize there is this. All these extremist groups believe that they are doing something very righteous. God is with them. They are serving God and his prophet and his religion. And so they are self-sacrificing for this great cause. I would say, actually, if you look a little bit deep down, what they are serving is their own arrogance, their own very selves, nafs, to use an Islamic term. Because what they're saying is, only we know what is right, and we have the right to impose this on everyone else. They're saying to other Muslims, you are not real Muslims, only we are the real Muslims. So they are venerating, praising their narrow conception of Islam, in which there is no modesty, in which there is no humbleness, which makes them pretty harsh, arrogant, and ultimately coercive and violent.
Thank you, Mr. Akul. You have raised very important and key points. Hatred was one of these important points that you mentioned. And also, you illustrated your points with good examples in contemporary world like ISIS, Taliban, and others. Regarding Taliban, I have to mention that recently they somehow enforced a new law by the name of moral law, or law of propagation of virtue and prevention of vice, which somehow restricted all rights of women. According to this law, they said that the voice of women is haram. It's prohibited for others to listen to the sound of women. And it will create a lot of challenge in our society. It means that women cannot go to doctors, women cannot be taking part in the society, in a lot of other issues. Music is haram, according to this law. Movement of women in the society is haram. Similarly, if you look to other groups like Boko Haram, for instance, in Nigeria, they are also imposing very, you know, harsh type of restrictions on women. They believe that there is no justification for modern knowledge in Islam, which is totally wrong, and you know better. Considering all these factors, practical factors, the Taliban, Boko Haram, ISIS, and others, if you say something about the key factors that have these factors, or what were those factors that contributed to the emergence of extremism? If you look back to the golden time of Islam, there was Dar al-Hikmah, there was interpretation of philosophy by Islamic scholars, and they benefited a lot from these philosophical points of Greek philosophers in Islamic history. But nowadays, we see there is a kind of contradictory approach by Islamic extremist groups against West, against non-Muslim communities. And this is somehow concerning all of us.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's important to remember that 12 centuries ago, the golden age of Islam, as many people call it, under the Abbasid Caliphate, early Abbasid Caliphate, included Muslim philosophers studying Aristotle or Plato, translating them into Arabic, and that initiated philosophical tradition in Islam and also medical tradition in Islam too. Muslims built hospitals and developed mathematics and algorithm at a time when the West didn't have these things. Now, it's important to note that they didn't say, Aristo and Plato is kafir, infidel, so we don't care what they teach. Well, some people would later say that and go against these philosophers and the tradition of learning from sources outside of Islam. But indeed, the early Islamic civilization was more open to all cultures and civilizations, and that was the key to its success. Because when you open up to the world and you get input from different cultures and civilizations, which are legitimate as long as they are not against the values of Islam. Because knowledge, human knowledge is universal. God gave akal, mind, to all human beings. And with that, they can develop good ideas and have inventions and maybe have some political systems or scientific knowledge that you can learn from. You're not supposed to learn everything from the Quran. The Quran itself gives you a vision of looking to the both East and West. They all belong to God, and you can be open in learning. Now, these groups, as you said, have a very narrow mindset. They refuse any idea that is coming from outside. And outside of Islam, even outside of their narrow sect of Islam, for example, some of those are Salafi jihadi groups. They would even refuse to engage with ideas coming from other Sunni Muslims, let alone non-Sunni groups like Shiites. So that is indeed a burning problem. And what they are doing supposedly is to defend Islam, right? I mean, to defend the truth of Islam. But what we have seen over and over is that they are only giving great harm to Muslims. First of all, by their violence and oppression, they are physically harming a lot of Muslims. I mean, we've seen people yelling Allahu Akbar and what? Then bombing a mosque and killing innocent civilians there. I mean, what can be more evil than that? But they're thinking they're serving Islam as they understand it. That's the maybe most extreme case. But also we've seen in regimes like Iran, for example, and I think Iran is a good example for the Taliban actually to look into, because the Islamic Republic of Iran in the over four decades that it's in power, what did they do is, just like the Taliban, they established a religion police force, you know, defined as the Committee for Commending the Right and Forbidding the Wrong, you know, Emr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar. That's a concept in the Quran. But they understand this as religious coercion, which doesn't have to be understood in that way. And they did, for example, what they did in Iran, for example, is to enforce the hijab. The Taliban goes further than that, not just enforce the hijab, but also, as you mentioned, just doesn't allow women to go around. Now, what it did to Iran is important here. It made Iranian society not more religious, not more respectful to religion, not more pious. Quite the contrary, everybody can observe that it made the Iranian society more secular, and it made many Iranians totally lose their respect, their faith in Islam. Because whatever you impose on people, especially in the modern age, it doesn't make their heart warm towards whatever you're imposing. They react to it. They think, if this was the truth, it would be preached, but why it is being imposed on me? That has certainly happened in Iran. That's why we've seen women burning hijabs in the Iranian streets while the Iranian regime is imposing on them. And I'm afraid now Afghanistan is on that path where Taliban will keep imposing a very harsh, rigid version of Islam, and a lot of people in Afghanistan will be rightly offended and alienated by that. And ultimately, that alienation will turn to Islam itself as a religion, which I, as a Muslim, would not want to see, of course. But that is the dichotomy we're seeing. Extremism in the name of Islam hurts Muslims themselves and even Islam as a religion.
Thank you, Mr. Akul. Yes, you touched upon very key points. The narrow interpretation of Islam and creating a lot of challenges and problems for Muslim communities. And that's why we have the term of Islamophobia in the Western societies. There is a kind of fear, a kind of concern in the Western societies about Muslim and Muslim communities. You have touched on very key point that even these radical groups and extremist groups, they have a kind of competition or a kind of negative stand about other school of thoughts within Islamic Sharia. As you mentioned, Hanafi against Salafi, Hanafi against Shafi, Shafi against others, Hanbali against others. Salafi says we are right. While we see, for instance, in Afghanistan, as a country, that most of the population are followers of the Hanafi school of thought, in Taliban alleging that they are supporting only Hanafi school, while we have a big part of the society followers of Shia school of thought, and they are also Muslim, while Abu Hanifa himself clearly saying in his chapter of Risalat al-Tawheed, says that La nukafiru ahlul qibla. We can't condemn any follower of Qibla, of Muslim direction, as Muslim, as infidel. It means that all Muslims should be seen as Muslim, including Shia or other followers of the school of thought. Unfortunately, they are not somehow bonding on their own school of thought. They are trying to do something to just to suppress the society and impose on communities, particularly on minority groups, their own policies, their own political agendas. In that way, they are causing harm for the society indeed. There's another question just I would like to ask you, that in what ways has extremism distorted the true teachings of Islam? If we have right things in Islam, how these people succeeded somehow to change the truth to their own interpretation or narrative, a dark narrative of Islam?
It's good that you reminded the great Imam Abu Hanifa, the founder of the Hanafi school. He was, in fact, much more open-minded, much wiser than many of the people who today claim to be Hanafis, and especially the Taliban, of course, is first and foremost among them. As you said, he was not doing any takfir against people of Qibla, the people who prayed towards Mecca, which means all Muslims, basically. I mean, if you're a Muslim and if your direction towards Mecca, we don't takfir on you. We might disagree with your theology or your jurisprudence. That's actually a noble principle, but we forgot. He was also a student of Imam Jafar Siddiq, which is the founder of the, of course, Jafari school, the main Shia school. So there's much wisdom there. Unfortunately, Hanafism went through several phases. It lost its early rationality and flexibility over time. And even under the Deobandi interpretation in the subcontinent, out of which later emerged the Taliban, it got into a pretty harsh mode. Now, you also made an important point. The Taliban is imposing Hanafism, among others. Right? It's not even an Islamic regime. It's a Hanafi regime. So they actually were outlawing Salafi practices and so on and so forth. And of course, Salafis would totally do that when they have power. Now, there's an interesting verse in the Quran that this bitter sectarianism among Muslims sometimes remind me. It's in Surah Rum 32, that is 30:32. And there, God tells Muslims, and do not be like those who divided their faith and split into sects, each rejoicing in what they have. Very interesting, because at the time when Islam came, Christianity, this verse could be referring to Christians. Christians were very divided, different sects, and they were intolerant against each other. There were bitter divisions about the nature of Christ. And of course, those bitter divisions and oppressions, mutual violence and oppression in Christianity, went on for 1,000 years at least until the time of liberalism. That's why John Locke had to write this essay, A Letter Concerning Toleration, saying that heretical groups should not be oppressed, you know, still it should be freedom, which was itself a heretical idea for some people at the time. Now, it's interesting that the Quran warns us not to be not like those who are divided and each rejoicing in what they have, which means each group says, I have the absolute truth. This is the right way of Islam, and others are misguided. Well, there is arrogance in that. And I think the more righteous way is to say, I follow this interpretation of Islam. We believe this is truer than others, but we respect others. Ultimately, God knows the best. And I think that modesty is the basis of toleration among Muslims. And ultimately, toleration among all people too, right? Because you can extend it even to religions. You can say, we follow this religion. It's our tradition. We believe this is the truth. But we believe there are pieces of truth in other religious traditions as well. And we respect them too. So the more we get away from that, we move towards this idea of one religious group dominating a piece of land, calling it an Islamic state, an Islamic khilafah or emirate, and then persecuting people who don't abide by its own religion. And this is a crisis, honestly, for the Islamic civilization. Christianity had similar ones, even worse ones. That's why in the 16th century, Europe was a land of bloodshed. Catholics and Protestants were slaughtering each other for decades and decades. And ultimately, they found peace of mind regarding religion by accepting what we call religious freedom today. They said, okay, let people follow their faith and let the governments do not take side in this. And that created these liberal societies that today most people, including Muslims, find peace in. And I think that's the direction we should head to. We should try to aspire for governments across the Muslim world that uphold justice, justice for all and all citizens and their rights and their freedoms. And people should be able to free their religious persuasions. I mean, if you, for example, if you believe music is haram, I don't believe that, but some conservatives do, then good, don't listen to music. Problem solved for you. But you're not going to go out and break people's music instruments and their cassette players or whatever today, which is, of course, the Taliban is doing. That is tyranny in the name of religion, and it is not helping religion at all.
Thank you. I think you described a very key point, which is tolerance. And tolerance somehow recognized by Islam. And a good example, I remember when I read in a book that when Harun Rashid had his trip to Hajj, and he met Malik ibn Anas. And when he met Malik ibn Anas, the founder of Maliki school of thought, he got interest to Malik's school of thought, because Malik was founded his school of thought based on hadith. And he was in all the time, he was living in Medina. He had full access to different sources for hadith. Harun al-Rashid asked him if he agrees, then Harun Rashid will impose his school of thought on the entire Dar al-Khilafah, on the entire territory of Islamic Empire at that time. But Malik ibn Anas rejected that request of Harun Rashid, saying that, no, let all communities on their situation, because each community has its own leader, religious leader. For instance, Imam Shafi was born in Gaza, Abu Hanifa was in Iraq. In other scholars somehow emerged at that time, like Abu Yusuf, Imam Muhammad, and others. He said, no, let people to follow their own school of thoughts. Don't impose my school of thought on all territory of Islam. And this is a good example of an emir or khalifa or sultan at that time, historical, very important point. In I mentioned this point sometime for the Islamic scholars, but unfortunately, nowadays, these extremist groups, as you mentioned before, they are trying to impose specific interpretation, specific school of thought, in a very dark interpretation from Islamic Sharia, unfortunately. Thank you so much for that. In there is another question that, if you a little bit elaborate about the, how these ideologies, extremist ideologies or interpretation of these groups, affecting Muslim communities internally within their countries and societies, and also externally from the viewpoint of other people, non-Muslim communities in the world. Because there is another issue we have to always consider, and I always been mentioned this issue to the university students when I was teaching at university, that look, there was at the beginning a line between Muslim community and non-Muslim community, Darul Harb and Darul Kufr. But nowadays we don't have this line. Muslim, you can find Muslim everywhere in the world. You can find non-Muslim everywhere in the world. There is global relations, globalization, communication, exchange of trade and money and things like that. How we can separate our world from another communities, another non-Muslim communities? This is something we have to consider always, and that's an important point. Mr. Akul, please.
Yeah, I mean, that old definition of the world or division of the world into Darul Islam and Darul Harb, that's the house of Islam and house of war, that, of course, doesn't come from the Quran. It comes from the medieval scholars' perception of the world, which maybe made sense at the time. Today, I honestly divide the world into Darul Hurriya versus Darul Zulm. In other words, lens of freedom versus lens of oppression. And in countries where you are free from the government's unjust oppressions, and where you have freedom of religion and speech and security and property rights and all that, I would defend them as lands of freedom. And they could be Muslim or non-Muslim. And Muslims certainly find more peace in these lands of freedom compared to the lands of oppression. That's why a lot of Muslims migrate from Muslim-majority lands and come to
Western countries such as US, Canada, or parts of Europe, precisely because they find more peace there, more opportunity there. So that old definition doesn't hold. Now, regarding Islamophobia and the non-Muslim perception of Islam, you mentioned Islamophobia before in the conversation. I've written about this, and I said sometimes there are two drives in Islamophobia or hatred of Muslims and Islam. One is there are people really, because of their own bigoted ideologies, their own racism or historical obsessions, hate Muslims and Islam no matter what we do. I mean, I've seen ultra-nationalist Serbs in the Balkans who hate Muslims and want to attack and kill them because to take the revenge of the Battle of Kosovo that happened in the 14th century. I mean, you can't do much about that. So that's really a pathological hatred. I see some groups, far-right Hindu nationalists in India too, who hate Muslims for Islamic conquest that happened like 1,000 years ago. So, or there are racists in the West who hate Muslims simply because they're brown-skinned or just because they have a different religion. So there are kind of those pathological, incurable Islamophobic ideologies. But also then there are people who would have nothing against Islam or Muslims. They're generally tolerant to everyone else, but they see the Taliban, they see ISIS, they see Al-Qaeda, they see this and that. So they see a lot of terrible things done in the name of Islam. And then they start to have this negative opinion. So I think in that sense, for the second type of Islamophobia, unfortunately, these extremist groups are helping generate Islamophobia. So we should see their own role in making of this unfair, of course, hatred and of Islam and all Muslims. So in that sense, extremism is harming Islam and Muslims because it is generating Islamophobia globally. And within Muslims themselves, it is leading to persecution, violence. It is also leading to these endless self-righteous, I am better than you disputes among Muslims. Even on the internet, if you're on Twitter, you can see Muslims sometimes bitterly disputing each other and calling each other names and because of things like the attributes of God or whether this fiqh, like legal opinion, is more justified than the other one, whether the Asharis or the Salafis or the Maturidis or this and that, which one is the most. Now, we can have those debates respectfully, saying that I think this opinion is more justified than the other opinion. But when you're an extremist, you think you have the right school because you're born into it most of the time. Somehow you're raised on it. And then you think others are misguided, and then you start to blame other people or those people who hate the modernists with more modern interpretations and all that. I think we should understand that with all that, we are just harming ourselves. We should establish more tolerance within Islam to different points of view. And we should learn how to say, well, we agree to disagree. I disagree with you on that, but I don't disrespect you, which is these extremist groups are certainly not interested in.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Akhil. As a last point or last question, how can the Muslim community and its allies work together to somehow do something about these radical groups? Because we are in a very critical time. Any suggestion, any idea, if you have?
Sure. First of all, I should one thing. We should also not lose sight that these extremist groups are sometimes fed by injustices done to Muslims globally by Western powers or Eastern powers such as China or Russia that interfere in Middle East affairs or can persecute their own Muslim minorities. So we should, in other words, we should not lose sight of the fact that in colonialism, imperialism, or interventions, military interventions can be counterproductive. I mean, one example is the 2003 occupation of Iraq, which ended up giving us ISIS, right, which we all hate. So there's that kind of counterproductive results of aggressive foreign policies of Western or non-Western, but, foreign governments as well. But regarding within Muslims, I think we need to articulate a narrative which challenges these groups and tries to win Muslims to the more moderate side. I mean, they're eating themselves in some case. I mean, the more you actually do a lot of terrible things in the name of Islam, the more people will start to hate you or despise you, or at least disassociate themselves from you. But also, it's important to have an alternative Islamic narrative, which is tolerant, which is respectful, which is modest, which is mature, and to show that this is the more righteous Islamic way. And to do this in a way that with a passion, because these groups have passion. That's also one thing that their advantage. I mean, the fact that they believe this is the only truth makes them pretty energized. And so their narratives, their publications, their internet messagings and all that are very passionate. And I think we need a passionate case for reasonableness, toleration. And we should be clear that this is necessary for Islam itself. This is necessary for the well-being of Muslims themselves. And Muslims will go back to a golden age or have another golden age in the future. In other words, Muslims will again have a civilization that is powerful and admired and creative and brilliant in many ways, only when they stop really using religion as a vehicle for oppression, for violence, for narrowing minds. Rather, it should be a vehicle for opening up minds for all the world, because the God created the world and we should be able to learn from all of it, and we should be able to engage with all of it with respect, with maturity, with dignity.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mustafa Akul, for joining us today in this podcast, and I hope to have you also in our other podcast in future too. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure, and I wish you well in this very important effort to challenge extremism in the name of Islam.